Okay, handing over to Catherine for Disclosure Initiative Paper Series 11.
Thank you, Sue. So targeted standards level review of disclosures. Last month, I'm sure you will remember that we completed technical discussions on the first of our two test cases, IAS 19. And with the first of our papers today, we hope to do the same with IFRS 13. Our second paper this morning is then all about the lessons we've learned throughout the process of testing our guidance for the board on those two standards. In terms of next steps, subject to decision making this morning, our next step will be to ask you for permission to ballot an exposure draft, and we plan to ask you that question in the March board meeting. However, before we are able to do that, we do need to complete our discussions on IFRS 13. So with that in mind, I ask you to first turn your attention to Agenda Paper 11A. So this paper follows up on a number of questions that the board asked us in a previous board meeting, and the paper is all about the board's IFRS 13 disclosure objective that requires an entity to disclose information that enables a user to understand the drivers of change in fair value measurements. Now, back in November, the board tentatively decided to treat a reconciliation from opening to closing fair value measurements as one way to meet that objective, but not the only way. However, at that meeting, board members also raised a number of concerns that they asked us to follow up on, and those are described in paragraphs 10 to 12 of today's paper. We think the board's concern that the disclosure objective as drafted could capture all drivers of change in all fair value measurements is valid, and consequently the first of our three recommendations in this paper is that the board amend that objective to refer to significant drivers of change. The items of information underlying the objective would help an entity determine what is significant. With regard to a reconciliation, it's very relevant to observe that last month the board decided to require an entity to provide a reconciliation in order to comply with a similar drivers of change objective in IAS 19, its other test case. For the reasons described in today's paper, we think it would be hard to justify an inconsistent approach here across our two test cases. And our second of three recommendations today, therefore, is that the board retain the level three reconciliation requirement that exists in IFRS 13 at the moment. We think that is in keeping with our objective because if they are material, movements in level three fair value measurements would always be significant. Our third recommendation then is that the board also include an additional item of information that, whilst not mandatory, would also help an entity to meet the objective. Now, that item is an explanation of significant drivers of change, if any, in fair value measurements other than those classified in level three. This will highlight to an entity that there will be cases in which information about other fair value measurements is also necessary to comply with the disclosure objective. As discussed previously by the board and summarised in the appendix, this is most likely to be the case if an entity has classified any material fair value measurements that fall within the grey area between level 2 and 3 classification into level 2. Finally, I'd like to highlight an editorial correction to the paper. In a couple of places, and most notably the recommendation itself, we include a paragraph that is the same as an existing requirement in IFRS 13, and that requirement is for an entity to include in its reconciliation gains and losses recognised in other comprehensive income and the other comprehensive income line item in which they appear. Now, in our paper, in that sentence, we have an incorrect reference to P&L rather than OCI. So just to clarify that, that will be correct in the staff update, and to congratulate the board for passing our test of how thoroughly you read the papers in advance of the meeting. So with that, I'm going to hand over and ask if you agree with our recommendations.
Charles.
First of all, generally, I agree with the direction. I think we should not require company to, you know, disclose all the drivers of the changes in February. I think it will bring huge burden to the companies. But what kind of wording we should use? Currently, we suggest using the significant drivers of changes. First, because at the general meeting, when we decided the IFRS 19, the reconciliation of changes in, you know, net defined benefits, liability, and assets, we use the wording main drivers rather than significant drivers. Mm-hmm. So I think we should be consistent. Secondly, we are proposing to change the wording significant accounting policy to material accounting policy with regard to the minor changes to the IS1. So I think that because significant drivers, I think to be consistent, it's better to using same wording as we decided at the January meeting. I think personally, I prefer main drivers rather than significant drivers, because in other areas we're also using significant, such as significant influence, something like that. So it's in different situation we have different meaning of significant. So in this case, I prefer to using main drivers rather than significant drivers. Secondly, about your third proposal, you will. Additional item that's not monetary, but maybe we ask encourage the entity to provide additional explanation of those main drivers of changes other than level three. Maybe so that means it could be level one, it could be level two. But the main intention behind it is that we worry about there are some gray area between level two and level three. And one thing I worry about that it will extend to further, because entity will think about level one, what kind of information they needed to additionally disclose. So it will add further burden, because as we said in the paragraph, I think, paragraph, which paragraph? Okay, paragraph 19A, one of our objective is to try to avoid some lengthy disclosure, which is not material. For level one, normally it's very clear there's a, you know, quoted price available, and whether it's really necessary for entity to identify what's the main driver of those, you know, fair value. So from my personal view, I hope that third proposal still to be limited area, that's a gray area we would like to address between level two and level three, at least not mention, not require entity to, you know, to disclose additional information with regard to level one fair value measurement. So these two comments.
Dell?
Thank you, sir. I agree with the support staff's recommendation. On paragraph 29, it seems that we are including here what would be the items that we are expecting to see the reconciliation. I'm just wondering whether item 3, for example, is part of item 2, is within item 2. It's important information, unrealized profit or loss, but actually it's not a reconciling item. It would be within the total gains or losses in P&L anyway. I don't know whether we should fix it. And also, on the following page, it's still within this reconciliation. We discuss the effect of foreign exchange rate differences. When we discuss fair value, for many fair values, actually we can't distinguish what is the fair value variation and what is the FX rate. And I was just wondering how it works in a situation where I have a forest in a foreign operation, whether I would segregate fair value of the effective difference, because I'm bringing these financial statements of this foreign operation into my financial statement, would be this be part of the fair value, or would I point out as an effect of foreign exchange rate difference?
Is this new or is this in 13 already?
So Dale's first point is in 13 already, so we're quite comfortable with the application of 2 and 3 relative to each other, because that reflects today's wording. The second point about foreign exchange is not there today, so the background to how that got in was last year one of the things we did was to work with the taxonomy team on a common practice review. So they'd done a very thorough assessment of what companies are actually disclosing in their notes at the moment, and one of the things they found was that companies are commonly choosing to the foreign exchange aspect even though they're not required to. So our conclusion from that was that then there is a likelihood that they're doing that because it's useful. So when we spoke to users as part of our outreach, we did ask that question, and those that commented did indeed confirm that it was useful. So for the fact that companies are choosing to disclose it already, we're confident that it can be done to the extent that was part of your concern.
But we sort of don't prescribe how they do it.
Yes, that is.
I mean, for a foreign operation or for financial instrument, I can't. But for some, if you just look at the financial statement of a foreign company, just doesn't have any foreign operation, I'm not expecting to see this FX rate. Because it's everything is fair value. I can't make the segregation. I'm just thinking whether someone could try to do that, just because we have these in the reconciliation. I can't attribute part of the fair value to FX rate. That's my raising point. I think that it will be a genuine item of reconciliation, but just be careful that in some cases I can't segregate FX effect from fair value.
The intention is not to require it. It's rather an example of an explanation that might be useful to meet the disclosure objective. Is that fair?
I mean, given that the reconciliation is required, the items in that list, if material,
you're choosing which items matter, right?
Bring it in. Yes, I mean, if something wasn't material or indeed didn't exist, then you know it wouldn't be given in the same way anything else would. But this whole thing has been elevated compared to the last time we discussed it. To this
and
Mary?
One other point here on the following page 11. In 19.3, this explanation of significant drivers of change. In the original proposal, we are in a certain way calling these items that we are putting as reconciling item as drivers of change. I personally have a different view of drivers of change. Drivers of change is price of, as I said, price of wood, price of the shares. These are really reconciling items. I don't know whether we could just clarify what we mean with significant drivers, especially considering what we had in the original wording.
Yeah, I mean, we would be intending to explain what was intended with that requirement in the basis, for example, and just in case there was an additional question there about potential different views on drivers of change, we are writing that to mean the drivers of the movement from beginning to end of the period. So you know,
that's why I think that's important to explain what driver of change means.
Mary.
Okay. I had raised my flag because I had a wording suggestion on paragraph 29 that I wanted to think about in the second paragraph that says to meet the objective. Now, I think we should say disclosing separately significant changes. So I'm suggesting adding the word significant there. If you look back to the first paragraph that you've highlighted, says in order to understand the significant drivers of change, but that's more in the nature of explaining how this is operationalizing the objective. Mm-hmm. I think we should be disclosing separately significant changes. I don't think we can rely on the word significant in the previous paragraph. Now, reacting off the on the fly to Tadeo's comment about foreign an investment denominated in a foreign currency, which is, you know, which is the circumstance you're talking about. I was trying to see, you used a non-financial instrument example. I think the financial instrument standard discusses the, you know, kind of the sequencing of measuring FX versus other changes in fair value when you have a foreign currency denominated in investment. And so I guess it's just, it might be an open issue if you have a non-FI foreign currency denominated asset, whether you apply the same thinking that's in the FI standard or whether you have developed an accounting policy that is different from the FI thinking about the separation of the FX component. You know the sequence in which you do it in terms of how much you ascribe to the change in due to FX and not when you're doing that measurement.
Awesome.
Yeah, man. I'm a little bit confused also with this wording of drivers of change, because, man, we, in the past, my thought it was okay that we would require kind of fair value increase because in level three, because liquidity in certain instruments have dropped or whatever kind of economic reason, as you also said, or that share price has increased in banking industry or in pharmaceutical or whatever. That was, for me, drivers of change. But now I think we're mixing it up because we're requiring now a level three, I would say, roll forward or reconciliation of the main, what is usually okay, addings because I buy something or reductions, I sell something or I have a P&L realization, this kind of traditional roll forward elements, which we require for level three, but then we're using for the same wording as also for what we require in addition for this kind of gray area. And I'm not sure what people would should do. And if they have, for example, in this gray area, would say they have a P&L from this gray area of two, a roll forward, because they cannot do it because it is not a specific term, as a kind of feeling what is a gray area. But in this regard, I think we mean more what are the drivers is more kind of maybe liquidity driven or price driven or
I didn't think we meant that, which is so it's a good
debate. I'm confused, I said that is my I'm not sure what we're really requiring then in
we're talking about economic you're talking about more economic drivers of change, so the fair value changed because liquidity changed or because market prices went up or something like that, whereas if you look at most of the list, FX is a little bit harder, but most of the list is about where are the debits and credits gone. Yes. Have I sold stuff? Have I bought stuff? Have I booked a gain in P&L? It's more accounting entries. Foreign currency, though, I think could be thought of in two slightly different ways. But I think it's mainly a sort of an accounting reconciliation, isn't it, if I can express it that way?
Yes. I mean, certainly when we had sort of previously worded it as it could be explanation rather than, you know, like mathematical reconciliation, a company would have had a bit more freedom, perhaps, to the extent that there was a movement that wasn't additions or disposals. It was the fair value has moved up or down. In explanation, you do have freedom to sort of say why that is and such, whereas a table will state that it's a movement. But that is what we intended.
I wonder whether something that might help, I think when we started, well, when I've been thinking about this, I've been thinking, maybe, I don't know correctly or not, that investors are interested in understanding, in part, whether your fair value, your amount of level three fair values have gone up because I've bought lots of new things that are level three classified, so I've got in purchases and an increase in volume, if you like, as opposed to have I got changes because the value of my level three items went up or down and I held them at the beginning and I held them at the end. Maybe if we gave that context for what we're trying to understand, it would help people think about what items should be in there.
I mean, I understand that, but what we then doing with 27Z, what are the drivers of change in these other areas? I don't. Should people say I have addings in level two because I
bought lots of level two items?
Sorry, I have
bought lots of level two items.
Is that what
I thought that
because
was
because they already have people,
yeah,
because they see a kind of level two assets will increase. And
it could be because I had the same number, but they all went massively up in value.
All or it could be because you transferred them.
Or you could, because you moved them into level three or level one. So that's the sort of stuff I thought we were focusing on. But clearly we need to be more clear because we've all got different understandings when we've read the words.
So if a company would say my level two assets increase and the main driver was because I purchased, it is then okay.
Yeah. That's what I was saying. Yeah. Is that Nick?
Yeah, I think that it's just it's a sense of unpicking that at a kind of big picture level.
So possibly, if it's helpful, I think the confusion has arisen because previously we had at the end of the whole recommendation examples of drivers of change are, and it's the stuff that is now under the reconciliation list. So I think the third bullet is potentially, you know, it needs a bit of clarification about exactly what we need by drivers of change, which we can certainly do in the basis and explain that it's that same types of movement.
Good.
Okay. Subject to the drafting comments that we've heard, can we vote on the question for the board, so whether we agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 27?
We're going to still using significant driver or
just drafting.
Well, I think we definitely need the same word in the
I think same
standards.
Word because January we decided to use
main drivers. Yes, 19 and 13. We're happy to say it's on the basis of the same word. I wouldn't want to hang my hat on which word right now because we would need to consider, so for example, Mary's point and how it would all fit together because that also related to the
consistency between the two.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we vote on that basis?
13, one absent.
So agenda paper 11B discusses the lessons learned from testing the draft guidance on IAS 19 and IFRS 13 so far. When the board set out on the targeted standards level review of disclosures project, it intended for that process to be iterated so that the board can update and improve the draft guidance in a timely manner. The board has now tested many aspects of the sections in the draft guidance, so we think it's important to consider the lessons learned at this time, in particular so that the upcoming exposure draft can reflect the board's most updated thinking about how to improve disclosure sections of IFRS standards. There are three areas that the draft guidance touches on and that we've tested aspects of. So firstly, using disclosure objectives. Secondly, developing the content of disclosure sections. And thirdly, drafting those disclosure sections. So starting first with using disclosure objectives, our lessons learned is described in paragraphs 11 to 17 of the paper. A key element to draw out here is that we think the testing process demonstrated that the board can develop detailed specific disclosure objectives that draw on user information needs. During the course of the testing, however, the board updated the format that it would use to articulate these objectives. And as we discuss in paragraphs 14 to 17 of the paper, we think that this updated format better reflects how the board expects preparers to use the objectives vis-a-vis the explanation of what primary users would do with information to meet those objectives. We think this is an area to add further clarification to in the upcoming exposure draft when describing this aspect of the draft guidance. Moving on to lessons learned from developing the content of the disclosure sections of IFRS standards, and that's described in paragraphs 18 to 28 of the paper. So here, as Catherine also mentioned earlier, we've worked with the IFRS taxonomy team. We've implemented a tailored outreach program with users at the onset and then subsequently with other stakeholders. Overall, we found these individual processes useful because they help to provide the necessary context to develop specific disclosure objectives for the test standards. A key aspect to highlight here is the tailored outreach with users. So the testing phase, we think, further highlighted that this is an absolutely fundamental aspect of improving disclosure sections of IFRS standards. We did, however, ask for a lot of time from users, so we think that the board will likely need to revisit the cost-benefit balance of this approach to user outreach at a later stage. As we describe in paragraph 25, we think this would be at the exposure draft stage, when the board is able to get a realistic picture from other stakeholders on whether the benefits of enabling more prepared judgment can be realized. Finally, on to lessons learned from drafting the content of the disclosure sections of IFRS standards, and this is discussed in paragraphs 29 to 42 of the paper. So this covers the use of language, leveraging guidance in other IFRS standards, and where to place high-level catch-all disclosure objectives. On the use of language, we think the board should update the draft guidance to reflect its more up-to-date thinking from the November 2019 board discussion, and that's as described in paragraph 32 of the paper. Furthermore, and for the reasons described in paragraphs 38 to 41, we think the board should update the draft guidance so that high-level catch-all disclosure objectives would be located at the beginning of the disclosure sections of IFRS standards. So with that overview, we have two questions for the board in this paper. The first is whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation on how to update the draft guidance at this time in paragraph 43. And the second is whether the board has any questions or comments about the matters that's discussed in this paper. So I'll turn it over to the board for discussion.
Are we doing, are we doing these questions together, or are they doing one then two?
I think we can do them together. Together. Okay. Nick.
Thank you. So thank you for the paper. I found it very helpful in crystallising my thoughts around this whole topic, and particularly what was expressed in paragraph 37, that we had avoided generic or overarching references to materiality in terms of setting our disclosure objectives. And it helped me think about what we're trying to do here and the different threads in the whole process. And I guess ultimately it is about materiality and the better application of materiality. But we've done that through our work with users in terms of focusing on relevance, really, and trying to have a more relevant set of requirements to begin with and then using that to explain to preparers the user need and why it's relevant. And hopefully through that process we'll get that better application of materiality. I think, obviously, our work by definition has been done on existing standards. I think we will have to think about this differently as and when we come to apply this to a new standard, because there won't be some benchmarks to put in front of users, for instance, or preparers to say, how would you move away from what we have today? And that may be more challenging. It will certainly be different. And then I guess the last point I have is and you refer to it in your paper in terms of how we move forward from here, particularly in terms of any field work we do. One very clear comment that we had, I think, both at the World Standard Setters Conference last year and we've had around this table, is in terms of the use of words and particularly how we're expressing some of these requirements, the ability of this to be audited and to have to get regulators particularly on side with this exercise is critical to take it forward. And so I wholeheartedly support the endeavour that you reflect in the paper to now bring those stakeholders in more into the equation here and get their views. Can we actually make this meaningful in terms of actually having tangible impact? So, for me, it was a very helpful paper. So, thank you.
Francoise?
Well, I'm very pleased with the overall effort of this project and very satisfied with its outcomes. So, thank you for that overall. My only comment relates to your proposal around the catch-all objectives and their location. Not sure I'm so fussed about the location, but I'm certainly very careful about the role it has to play. I think a big improvement that we have in this project is to move away. We've moved away from a general high-level objective that was just supplemented by a list of very detailed requirements. And we have moved to having requirements in the form of objectives. So to me, this reform is successful if we ensure that people understand exactly that every objective is a requirement and are able to derive what they have to do from that. So to me, the catch-all objective was, here we have identified a number of objectives that you have to meet in order to provide relevant information in your disclosures. There may be situations in which to ensure that, for example, a user can forecast future cash flows, some supplementary information may be needed. And so to me, this cash flow objective is really there to have people. They have already prepared what is needed to meet the disclosure that we have identified. They have to stop and wonder whether anything else would be needed. And to me, it's important that they understand what is expected from them. My concern is that if we bring that objective back up, where in a number of tenancies already is, it's going to lose its role and the understanding that people should have of it. Martin?
Yeah. For me, it is too early to say what are the lessons learned, because when I said it from the beginning, I think it is a kind of, I'm not happy if we go now into exposure draft and getting all the feedback sent and then saying, okay, that is what we are doing. I think we need a kind of, what I would say, testing of that. We have gotten a lot of detailed input from users. We had some input maybe from GPF, from our groups, but we don't have a broader field test or kind of this stuff, because especially with also this fair value, always said, okay, we tested it with a big financial institution, that it is handable and people can read kind of objectives and then know what they do. And also with regulators, are they happy then? Is that enforceable based on the objective? We need kind of auditors in the UK. Can I audit that based on this? And so I'm really not happy if we now come and say, okay, lessons learned and we are happy and that this will working. And for me, it is something missing. And so I'm missing with, we have involved, I agree with that, a lot of users. It was a great work, big work, but then the other stakeholders which we have, who has also to deal with that, can they work with that? I think we need a kind of, I'm not sure if it is a kind of field test. Maybe we need some 10 big companies, some invite some regulators, auditors, and because for me it is to kind of test all that with an exposure draft and then people agree with that and then making it live is a bit risky for me, I have to say. And therefore, I think it's a little bit too early to say lessons learned and let's bring all this into the draft, and because testing is for me finally works and I have not seen that. It's good, but I don't know.
If I may just make one comment, I completely understand the point that you're making. I think it's a very fair challenge for us as we move forward. Just to say that one of the challenges we faced, perhaps sort of in the early part of last year, talking to certain stakeholder groups other than users, was that without absolutely clear examples on the table of these are exactly what revised standards would look like if we revise this approach, the discussions are a little bit on the hypothetical side, in that without a clear this is what IFRS 13 would look like if the board were to take this track, it's quite difficult to then expect companies to say, well, this is how we would apply it, this is what our financial statements would look like, the same with auditors, regulators. So we do absolutely agree with the challenge you're raising, but for us, we feel like the time to do it is when we can put an actual set of draft amendments on the table and ask people to field test the consequences of those.
Mary?
I think commenting on the same points.
One thing about the lessons learned, and is this the right time? I think it's the right first time to think about lessons learned, not the only time we do. Yeah. You know, just to kind of capture from the first round of experience what we learned. And I think, you know, we have to be clear that we'll go back and look at it after we've re-deliberated the feedback we get on the exposure draft, which does raise a general question we might be still fumbling and not certain of the answer on. This is, what is the status of the draft guidance? Now, I see that you say in the document that we'll discuss the draft guidance in the basis for conclusion. And, the thinking about this kind of percolating for several days,
I tend to think that we should be publishing the draft guidance rather than just describing it. But I think it's not, it's a document without stated, it should be a document that does not have a status. It's not part of IFRS standards. And that's different from being, let's say, non-authoritative, like a basis for conclusion. It's a standalone as part of our process documents rather than, part of the standard itself. But I think it would be not just useful and interesting, but very helpful to us to publish the current draft of it when we publish this document to allow people to both see it as a working document and to see if they have any comments on that and to understand its relationship with that. So I think that's something we have to think about, but we also have to think about how we describe it because we have the things that are defined as part of IFRS standards, and then we have things like a basis for conclusion that is very important context for authoritative literature. And this is kind of a procedures document, but it's not quite the same as some of the operating documents that we have for the board and interpretation committee. So I think we should think about that. But that also, in a couple of paragraphs, I think it's paragraphs 34 and 45, you talk about field testing. And I wasn't sure, I wanted to ask if you could comment about conducting your plans to conduct field work with stakeholders and how that relates to the discussion in paragraph 34, do field work to test the approach you described there with stakeholders. And just give me a better idea of what you're planning.
I will try and answer that question. Tell me if I fail. With regard to the language piece particularly, the sort of fundamental question that we need to ascertain the answer to is there any risk whatsoever of the concern that some board members raised at the beginning of a company picking up these requirements, thinking the objectives are applied in the way that they've applied objectives in the past and not really being complied with directly, they've just gone straight to the checklist of an entity shall and entity shall. Then when faced with the less prescriptive words that underlie them, they go, I've considered it and I'm moving on. Like, is there a risk of getting nothing? For all the reasons that we've discussed over the last 2 years, we feel we've covered that in our drafting, but we simply cannot conclude that ourselves until we've gone out and asked companies with an exact example in front of them of what this would look like. Do you understand that you simply must comply with the objectives and this is helping you do it? Ask auditors, okay, if a company came to you and had done X, Y, or Z in compliance with this objective, would you be able to assess whether they had complied with the objective, given that you no longer have a checklist of stuff to just go, yes, it's there, no, it isn't there? And the same with regulators. Is it possible to enforce this? So those are the...
That's the field work that you want to do. Okay.
Rika?
Thank you. I think... when I considering the current business environment and the situations, I don't think a checklist type disclosure requirement will not really work in practice. So I think that this model, I like this model, and this model of structure and how to the entity need to consider the how to achieve the objective of the ultimate disclosure and think about what type of item should be provided. But at the same time, I still have concern, and I also have asked a question many times about how to apply this prescriptive language of the while not mandatory. Now, we discuss again, and I understand what we really mean it, but maybe outside this room, people are not so familiar about how to apply this prescriptive language in practice. That means I really think we need to include a clear explanation on the statement to support what our expectation to entity consider when this prescriptive language is used. And also, not only preparers, but also I really, it is critical to receive the feedback from auditors and regulators, how they think about the auditability or enforceability of using this language in practice. All right.
Joel, thank you. A lot of comments on this document in it, but first kind of reflecting on the process that got us here, I'd say this has been a long and arduous journey for the two staff, probably longer than we envisioned and as you sort of acknowledge in here. So I think we all got said, I think we finished, we're in a good place at the moment and for the most part agree what's in here. Just, I do have comments throughout, but they're probably more cautionary than disagreements. I think, you know, the beginning place, going forward, assuming this becomes the model, and I hope it does, it's the defining and articulating the objectives becomes the challenge. It's not the punch list of things that might cause it here. And I think what we're going to end up with, there'll be still the objectives, they'll still fall into half a dozen more or less standing objectives, you know, at, that will be tailored to individual projects. So I can't envision we would not have an objective that requires us to reconcile beginning to end of year changes, you know, for significant changes in the accounts or something. I think we're going to probably likely have objectives. What are the recognition principles you chose, whether it's a selection of accounting principles or whatever. I think there's likely to be generally objectives about what were your measurement challenges. And what are your, I think there's likely to be, what are the risks in these accounts or the contingencies against the accounts? I think that's going to likely be an objective forward. I think we're likely to have an objective disclose future commitments that exist at the balance sheet date. It's hard to envision on any important recognition, on any important financial statement element that we're writing a standard on, that these, for the most part, aren't going to be objectives. The issue would be how do we tailor them to that subject as opposed to have them just sticking with a generic model. I think time will tell on that. This is a good example, these two projects, of how we've tried to do that. I think it needs going to be some refinement, some experience going forward, but it's hard to envision we would not have objectives in those spaces going forward, and then ones perhaps more subject-specific. I think with respect to a drafting guide, I think I'm kind of agreed with Mary, we should probably have a drafting guide, but it's the first draft, or the first iteration. I think this becomes iterative going forward in here, because I'm not sure where we put it, though. It's not a standard. It's got elements of conceptual framework. This is things we should think about, you know, as we're developing standards. It's got elements of a due process handbook. This is how you shall operate. But it's not quite there either. But I think we should memorialize it and have it someplace that's not just visible to us, but visible to anybody that chooses to see it. I think some specific comments inside the document itself, and I'll just very quickly go through them. Paragraph 15, in the opening it, I agree it's not the preparer's job to do the analyst's work for them, but I think it's the preparer's job, and ergo our job, since ultimately our work product is instructions to preparers, is to position the information for an analyst to efficiently do their job. But there is very clearly a line in practice between accounting and analysis. It's a gray line, and it's not clear and precise, but analysts, I think, tend to, we're on our side of the line, accountants are on your side, just help us do our job well. And I think that's sort of where, you know, these disclosures, you know, are positioned to be done. I think on paragraph 37 is my next comment about materiality. Yes, it is an overarching concept. The guidance we put out years ago on IS-1, quite frankly, has not caught on the way we wanted it to. I would personally prefer, even though I think I'm a minority, that we should be constantly reminding us to write disclosures if material. And I know the throwback, go back to IS-1, but we put words, you know, that materiality trumps words like shall and must. It's caught on, but not where we would have hoped it would be 5 years later. I personally think we should keep repeating it every opportunity we can for a while. More than once I've been told that, well, that's a general standard, that's a specific standard, does not override it, and the board cannot have been clearer that it does. So that tells me it hasn't caught on where we expected it to be. Then I think paragraph 43 about the high-level disclosure catch-all, I'm not too excited if it should be the beginning or the end. I think just kind of go with whatever makes sense in it. My concern here is about being careful how you articulate these in standards. I envision the high-level catch-all is if you've got something anomalous, unique to you, talk about it, that if it's otherwise material. This is not to give an very broad and general for auditors or regulators or anybody else to say, well, you should do this even though it's not in there. That's not what this is about. It's for unique, you know, anomalies, at least in my estimation. That's what it's for. So I think a lot of care is needed such that this just doesn't become a wedge for somebody and say, well, it says it in there generic, I think it's important. That I don't think that's what that's about. And then lastly, count words or requirements or anything. But as I reflect on what we did on 13 and 19 here, net-net in terms of you did a word count, I'm not sure there's much less disclosures that will emerge when someone tries to write these footnotes against these new standards. I could be wrong on that, but it feels like the bulk doesn't change much in there. And I think there had been an expectation in the marketplace there'll be less disclosures when you're said and done by a considerable amount. I don't think where we are in these, that expectation would be achieved. I'm not saying it's a right or wrong expectation, but I do believe it was an expectation. And I think something to be clear is there's not a significantly reduced bulk of disclosures emerging out of this. Again, that's willing to be proven wrong on that, but that's sort of my sense reading of where we came out against what used to be there. And that's okay. I'm not disagreeing with that, but I think that will be against the expectations that the world is out there. We should just be prepared to have a response to it.
Okay, so a couple of comments on your two questions. I don't want to speak last because I don't have anything profound to say. But in terms of the first question, I think what you're really asking us is should we update the guidelines for our current thinking, and I think that makes sense. I'm taking that in the spirit of this isn't the end of the story, but let's at least update for where we're at, and I think that makes sense. I'm not so sure about the idea of putting the guidelines into the public sphere, not because I'm, and I don't feel super strongly, not because I want them to be secret, but I think in terms of messaging what that means, it could be a bit tricky. So we don't want to start getting letters to the Due Process Oversight Committee because we drafted something in a way that's not consistent with the drafting guidelines. And there's, you know, as soon as we, you know, what sort of formality? We just have to be, I think, very careful with the consequences and the messaging if we put it in. Not that I want it to be secret, but, you know, how might it be used? I think we just need to think carefully about that. In terms of sort of just a few broader observations and in the spirit of trying to be constructive. Like Martin, I've been thinking about what our sort of next steps are. And I think for me that we definitely know that something doesn't seem to be working now. So we definitely know that writing things the way, well, for whatever reason, maybe partly because of the way we write things, but how the market works, we're not getting the best outcome in the world at the moment with disclosures as we've got it today. And so we all know we want to do something to try and improve that situation. And it feels like the right approach to do that is to make sure we understand what users' needs are and to articulate things the way we're doing, so I'm completely supportive of what we're trying to achieve. And I think, you know, we can't argue with the objective of trying to, you know, focus on what do users need to understand. It seems like the right approach. For me, what we need to be careful of, though, is that we don't sort of overcorrect. So by, you know, dramatically changing the way we draft things, do we get a sort of an overcorrection in a way that we didn't anticipate? And that's really, for me, ultimately what I want to get comfortable about. And one of the things I am a little bit concerned about still in the back of my mind is that the users have hand on heart told us what information they need to understand. And we're trying to write requirements in a way that ends up with them getting that information. But if the way that we write it doesn't have that effect, they're not going to be happy either. And so I think we just need to be careful that even with all of the will in the world of trying to be clear of what people need to understand, if the consequences they actually don't end up with the information, they're not really in a better place than they are today. And it's quite hard for us to roll back once we move from objective-based. So I want to do everything we can think of to try and get the comfort that this approach is going to enable preparers to think about what users want and result in the information actually being provided in practice. Now, I think we've got a couple of... And that's hard to do with an ED, because people are never going to think as hard about it as they will when they actually have to pick something up and apply it. We know that with every standard. Not because anybody's evil. They just, you know, it's not your day job. Nobody's going to spend hours over, you know, hundreds of hours looking at EDs and thinking about how exactly they'd apply it. They're looking at it to see on the, you know, sort of on the surface to an extent, does this seem like a good approach or not? And we only really know what's going to happen when the sort of rubber hits the road and it goes through the process. So I'm trying to think in the back of my mind of all of the tools we might have that gives us a little bit of extra comfort above and beyond our normal processes. One of the things we could think about, for example, is we've got some more objective-based stuff already out there. So if we went to users today and said our new ECL disclosure, expected credit loss disclosure requirements, say you need to understand all of these things, they would probably look at the list, I hope, and say, yes, that's the stuff we want to understand. You've captured it there in your standard. But if I then pick up some financial statements of banks around the world and say, so is this the information you wanted? I'm not sure they're going to say, yes, that's the information I want. But that's the consequence of us having described what we know investors want. But this is how it turned up in practice. And I think we need to, it might be, then we might have the opportunity to look at some of the more recent standards to see what's come out from our words, and then to spend some time with investors to see, can they actually cope with the lack of comparability that is coming from more objective-based disclosures? And to the extent where we actually think the information isn't meeting the objectives, talking to some preparers and some auditors and regulators to understand whether there were conversations that went on about whether or not the objectives had been met, and if there was something in the words that meant that they couldn't get people to do more, or where preparers didn't understand they needed to meet the objective. How did our drafting, if the answer didn't get to where we wanted, what can we learn from our current drafting that we use to try and get a better outcome? Because that's a better test for me than in theory, if you were to apply these words, do you think the outcome's going to be good or not, which is a harder test. And then the last thing I wanted to say was I think that the process we've got here is a really good process, this idea of spending time with investors. It took more than we expected, but using investors to help us craft the objectives, I think, feels like it's the right approach and to test. But I'm a little bit worried that in the building we're missing that first step in other projects, and this isn't directed at you guys, it's sort of directed at us, because I think our old standards, we were rightly sort of questioned for whether we really understood what information needed to be provided, and so we were coming with a sort of vacuum or our assumptions of what information needed to be disclosed in writing requirements. I'm a little bit worried that we might be morphing to coming up with our own ideas of what we need in the objectives without testing too much with investors and writing them down, and just because we've drafted them looking like an objective, somehow we're meeting our guidelines. And so I worry on other projects we're missing the first step.
It's not enough just to phrase it differently. We're meant to be making sure we really understand what investors want to understand and not just those ideas ourselves. So I think that's probably for us and for Neely. But yeah, subject to all that, it's good to try. Tom?
Just Mary popped up in the last. Is it a small follow-up on Sue?
Go ahead. Don't worry.
Because I have a few things.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. All right. Okay, so I have actually split in questions one and two. I have a couple of stuff on question one. I actually want to pick up something Sue said. So in this exposure draft, in particular the guidelines, and it wasn't clear to me exactly, are we talking about putting these things in, like, here's all the new objectives and required and, while not mandatory, does that all go in the exposure draft along with our process?
Yeah, so our plan, subject to, you know, different preferred approaches, is that the exposure draft would look like a set of amendments to the two standards, so literally the amendments that have been tentatively decided upon, and then in the basis we would have the guidance. And then in all of the explanation in the basis that explained how we got to the amendments, we would effectively be explaining why the board developed the guidance in the way that it did, and then have that basis for each of the two standards, if that makes sense.
I hadn't formed it as clearly as Sue, but I actually quite worried about commingling these two things completely in one document. So suppose I like the product in 19 and I don't like the product in 13 and I'm halfway on the process. Like, how do I respond, sort of thing? Because the process is going to apply to these standards, going to apply to everything, and it is going into how we do things, and it's really important that people separate their comments on the process and do you think this is an effective process, and whether it came out with exactly the right answer or not in this case, I want to know what you think about the process. And by having them tightly linked, especially if people are reading it quickly, they'll say, well, you know, the process must be bad because they didn't like something in 19, for the sake of argument. So I'm not saying don't do it that way, but I really think if it is one document, it's got to be somehow really segregated, and the questions have to be really segregated. Whether maybe you could go as two associated documents at the same time, I would think really hard about that part. And then I want to go on also on question, I think this is on one, actually it was related. I did want to support, I think, Françoise's earlier comment. I think she opened up. And just in, for this to work, and it goes a little bit to, I think Gary said, you know, this isn't, some people are expecting less. And what this is aimed at is better. And better might be more and it might be less. And I think it links a bit to me what Françoise said, and I'm paraphrasing or what I kind of got was the objectives that are required, and then she had a big and she, please correct me if I'm wrong, one can derive what you need to do from the required objective with respect to all this other thing that follows. And I think that and is however we write it, and please correct me if I've got it wrong, that's essential for this to work, so that when people look at that big objective, it may lead to less, but they're going to, I think as they go through, because the onus is on you to fulfill an objective, hopefully what you put out there is really useful stuff, and you're not simply responding to the, I must say something about X because it says I have to say something about X. So that's, I like that tone, and I don't know if that's what Françoise is getting at, but then you have to absolutely have the objective really clear, and if I got it right, the preparers need to understand what the objective requires of them, and the users need to understand what the objective requires of the preparers. So I just wanted to support that as being a really important part. And then on just, I think, 43B on the catch-all, I like the catch-all at the front. Again, I think, because I have the sense of you start with principle and get more specific, and so I like it there. One of the things we talked about early, and I didn't see it here, is at the end, there's a catch-all task. It's not a thing. The catch-all task is to take a look at that initial objective, the overriding, the big one, then look at all your objectives, and then say, have we satisfied it with all these things that we've done? So it forces whoever, it's a task that you have to do at the end of the process to go back through and make sure that it's all useful and that there's no significant thing missing or material thing missing. So that still has to be in there, is that there's a task that, in other words, the objective's at the beginning, but the task is at the end. So I think it should be clear. You look careless.
My facial expression is because I am thinking that our intention is that we want to make very clear in our document that with the high-level catch-all objectives, the expectation is that an entity will do exactly what you've described. So what that paragraph requires an entity to do is assess, have I captured everything by complying with the specific objectives? And we think that with every paragraph out of our standards, preparers and auditors and everyone will be thinking, what is this paragraph in practical terms telling me to do? And we have a challenge for ourselves to make that clear. Whether it's at the beginning or the end, we would hope that everyone would still understand that that is what was intended. Yeah. So having two things with the same practical intention.
And I think that, to me, the tension, I like the objective at the beginning. As I said, to me, it's always the objectives should be at the beginning, but the task reminder is, or your timing of the task is at the end, and you look back. But anyway, however you want to write that. So those are the kind of question one things. Mary, do you want to jump in before I do question two, which are totally off in a different place? So question two, I had, first of all, a question about the sample. Just when I went back to September, one of the things that we said was that we would collaborate with national standard setters to arrange user group. And so my question was, when I looked at the sample, it didn't really say how you identified the 35. And I kind of remembered talking about we would use national standards or this or that. So could you just kind of give us a bit of background about how the 35 were identified?
Well, I mean, the short answer to that was we worked with the investor engagement team, and they have, I don't know how to describe it, like a list of six different criteria to assess the effectiveness of a piece of investor outreach. You know, have we covered buy side? Have we covered sell side? Have we covered jurisdictions? And different ways in which teams can achieve that. So we worked with them in reaching out to and identifying all of the investors that we spoke to, and then at the end of that process, we kind of assess, well, do we feel we've covered every aspect of this that we feel we need to be able to move forward. I don't know if that's a detailed enough.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to know because I just was thinking about this, and so one comment is going forward is in terms of process, and this is getting into details, is when do you want to reach out to national standard setters, and how would you reach out? What about national standard setting bodies that have their own user advisory groups, and do we encourage them to help, you know, increase the sample and things? So I just sort of this identification is something that could be developed over time more precisely as we go through over and over again.
Yes. So, I mean, without going into endless detail, when we did it for this project, there were, for example, instances where we would identify a gap as we went along. So we might have identified a jurisdictional gap in which that would have been a time when we might reach out to a national standard setter to help us fulfil that. There might have been a time when we identified an industry gap, for example, and we would be looking to use, you know, the different channels we have to make sure that we had fulfilled every need. But I would say it was a case of responding to what was happening and making sure we'd covered everything.
Okay, then the last thing I have to say, and this is a concern, and I was thinking about it a little, is there's really no place in our process for research, whether it be by professional associations, other standard setters, academic research. It's just not, when I look through all the thing, there's no place that says, what do we know from research by all these groups about this topic? And so that's a concern to me. When I went back through the documents, and there's sort of in September, there's a small reference about kind of reviewing the literature at an early stage, but then there's nothing about using research findings or whatever. And so to me, that's a concern, because I think we need to be evidence-based, and the evidence that the process and the evidence we've collected in this is very good, but it's not the total set of possible evidence. And to me, the way the process seems to be working, it's going to preclude what could provide some significant evidence.
So just to clarify that within our guidance, we have a section on understanding what the existing issue is. And within that, we have a bullet which is identify the scope of the issue, review literature, and do other research. And I could continue, but there are things in there.
24B, that's the one I referred to.
Okay. And when you may not recall, it was a while ago and it was very detailed, but when we were sort of making that assessment for the two standards that we have, so some of the work that Aisha did was reviewing those kinds of information to the extent that we had them available. So I wouldn't say that we don't have that at all.
I didn't go that. It's all these things are all a matter of degree, and which is why I did cite it, is that it seems to be it's sort of very early at just issue identification, and I think you can actually learn more than just kind of issue identification from research. There's a lot of research out there, and in other places, for example, the PFS, we relied on surveys, for example, done by the CFAs, and we relied on all sorts of stuff that looked at the current state of MPMs in practice, and all, you know, there was a lot of stuff. And again, it'll vary from thing to thing, but when I look at the summary in this document, when you say, here's our process, to me, this is sort of giving a sketch of what the process is. And that's why I went back and looked, because there's no reference in this particular document.
Can I interject? Catherine, I might say something that's completely wrong, in which case just tell me that it's completely wrong. But I think what you're describing about the evidence-based and the academic research, that's the sort of...
I just want to be stressed, all research.
All research, yeah. Yes, absolutely. That's the sort of thing that would take place throughout every step of standard setting. And I think what we're trying to capture here with the disclosure guidance is the incremental things that we're doing specific to disclosure. And so I think that's why it's not...
That's what I'm saying, though, is I think you can learn about disclosure from research.
Right. And I'm saying this is not precluding that. It's just it's the sort of thing that takes place throughout all of what we do in standard setting.
Okay. I'm sure we'll make sure to use relevant research, but yes.
Hey, Jingtao?
I agree with staff's recommendation in paragraph 43 to update our draft guidance. It reminded me why we decided to do it, because we are aware of the existing disclosure issues. Some companies disclose too many irrelevant information to the users and did not disclose sufficient relevant information to users. So this is why we decided to introduce those, prescriptive language and less prescriptive language, and try to test those draft guidance with two targets, standards. So by now we have done a lot of work. So I think it's time to update that. I think it's the right way to do. The key is that, as I think Lucas mentioned before, the key is that whether those new language and new requirement works as we expected, and whether the stakeholders really understand our intention, whether it really can lead to behavior changes. It's relevant behavior, not only relevant to the language. So I appreciate that actually we are aware of it. So we are going to conduct field work to engage those preparers, auditors, and regulators to test our principle, our guidance. So I think it's very good, very good. But two things I think I would like to mention again, mention is that first, when we do this field work, I think we will not only simply look at those contents, those wording, disclosure contents, try to focus on whether it's really lead to those behavior changes. That is very, very important. The idea, their behavior changes. Secondly, I think Sue also mentioned that at the first stage, we engage those users, and we receive their demand and decide to test those changes. But when I look at the field test work we are going to do, the stakeholder we are going to engage is preparers, auditors, and regulators with users. I still would like to bring those users in based on a new proposed disclosure and to double check whether those new disclosures really meet the demand of those users, whether those users are happy with those new disclosures, whether they understand it, and to double check whether it works. I think it's very important. But don't forget the users, bring them together.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Cheng Wu, have you given up?
No, I was kidding. Well, I discussed.
Are you sure?
Yes. Okay.
Sorry. Mary?
Three smaller comments. Thinking again about, Sue, your comment about getting in investor needs. It took more time than we expected, and that's when we had the advantage of investors having worked with the output of existing requirements. So we had existing requirements, disclosures had been made, and people were familiar with them. I think it's going to be even harder when we're saying these are the changes that we're thinking about making to recognition and measurement and presentation. And so what are your needs then? It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just, I think it's tempering expectations about how hard it's going to be and how much time might be required. And I think it might be worth, and I'm not sure when in this process of ours, talking to several of our consultative bodies about how they think to best engage about this, what kind of approaches, small group, whether there's education or priming in some way when we're talking about possible changes to requirements. So that's just a thought about that. I don't know that it needs capturing in any formal documents. I just think let's get everybody's expectations about this is not an easy thing, and it's going to get harder rather than easier. In terms of the field work that you're planning, I think Sue's points about looking at the experiences of IFRS 9, I think there's also IFRS 15 has some aspects of that, more objective focus. I think that probably should be part of our field work, not seen as a separate thought about whether or not we do it, but field work connected with this. And Tom made the comment about separating the task from the placement of, the catch-all objective. And that made me start thinking about the process that's set out in the materiality practice statement, where that's more describing a process for how you think about approaching the task than it is the requirements. And it does make me wonder if we need to think about if it would be useful to start thinking about articulating a process. And I'm trying to dredge up. I have a feeling that you might have looked at that materiality process when developing the process here. I don't know where it would sit, how what it would be, et cetera, but just maybe something to think about, because I think the feedback that we've heard from the materiality practice statement is that people have found a description of a kind of a process to be a helpful complementary tool.
That's awesome.
Well, I want to comment on two points following this discussion. The first one is about the field work. And I generally very much support that we do field work, and in this particular case, even more. And I also agree that a very important aspect of that fieldwork would be to see whether the way we would draft disclosure requirements would be enforceable. I mean, that's the key question. But at the stage in which we are in this project, we have made a number of decisions that I think for our credibility and effectiveness we should stick to. We decided that we would test a new approach on the basis of two standards. We have selected out of a list, we have consulted on what these tests should be, we have, as the staff has put into evidence, the phase in which we have consulted with users has been longer than expecting, meaning we have required, we have consumed resources from users because they expect an improvement out of it. So I think we need to continue with what we've decided to do, test on the basis of these two standards, have a great emphasis on fieldwork, and if we are not, if we do not have enough confidence that where we are have gotten to meets the level of enforceability which is necessary, we will back from. We will derive from all these efforts the fact that what we had aimed at doing and tested is just not successful. I think that starting to say, well, now we are close to, we're getting closer to reality check, and saying we're going to look at work that by the way, I think this survey about how our disclosures are effective on the new standards are something that needs to be done. But I don't see it as a step into what we've decided to do. I think it's an interesting step of its own. I don't know at what time it should be done, but it's something certainly to. But it's not something that's going to enlighten us as to whether the choices that we've made, the decision that we made, the process that we have followed is a successful one or not. I don't think that, to me, it's a side. And I really think in terms of also our credibility and effectiveness, as I said. The second point I wanted to make is about the status of this guidance. I think it's important, and in fact I like the location that the staff has proposed in the basis, because the basis explains how we make decisions, why we make them, and the fact that we have followed a particular process in order to improve our own discipline on hard setting disclosure requirements is, to me, falls into this area of explaining our decision process. I would not make that a formal document, largely for the reasons that Sue has highlighted. It's just one, I mean, everybody has their internal processes, and here we display to get people understand where the discipline comes from. But that's just an explanation that we give in as we give others. So I like that location. But I really insist that we continue on the basis. We don't freak out just because we are afraid of not getting to. We, after an exposé draft, after field work, and with the large consultation, if we're not satisfied that it's good enough, we have the decision to make, not to progress. Yeah, and I'm going to stop just before knowing.
I don't necessarily disagree with you, so I don't know that we're in that different a place, because I think you are mainly referring back to my comments. I'm just trying to think ahead to what will give me the confidence we've got enough information to be able to assess the enforceability aspect. And I'm just speaking for myself. I think if we could find some ways to at least investigate some aspects of some existing words for some live action, and speaking to the regulators about any experience they do have, that might be relevant to help assess that enforceability question. I think that's it's just mm-hmm. help. What evidence do I need? We might want, you know, we might think we need different levels of evidence, but that's really what I was getting at. Nick?
Thank you. So I am very supportive of the overall process here, but I know there are risks. I know we have to explore those now. I do have a organisational concern at the moment, though, and it partly touches what Mary reinforced about we will need to think about this differently in terms of new requirements around presentation, measurement and recognition. And I guess what I slightly worry about is that I see parts of this process now starting to embed into our existing standard-setting work, and I'm not sure doing something partial necessarily is the right... I just think we need to think about how we handle that. I think there are potentially some risks in that, and we just need to be careful.
Because we haven't tested the enforceability. If we all conclude it's enforceable, that's great, but... Yeah. No. Anne?
I want to comment on this idea that there could be evidence, looking at our existing standards, that are relevant to what we're doing here. And for some time we've been asking the academic community to have a look at 9 and 15 specifically, because they've got disclosure objectives there. Can you have a look at this, and can you give us some evidence that can feed in specifically to this project? Haven't seen any response yet. However, this year in 2020, our research forums in Oxford, and Anne McGeachan and I have already tentatively put in the program sessions on 15 and 9, and those specific sessions would be about gathering feedback. So I think if I get with Anne and Anna and do some work on how we could use those sessions specifically to try and extract information on the disclosure objectives, I think that might be worthwhile. I'll let you know what our thinking is.
Okay. All right, I don't think we need to formally vote as such, do we?
We do on the first question.
Just on updating the guidance. Okay, so on question one, show of hands for who supports updating the guidance to reflect our current work.
11, one absent.
Sorry,
if I may say, I support that we update the guidance as part of the iterative process that we've decided. I still can't agree to having the high-level objective in the beginning if I don't see how this is articulated in terms of making the requirements clear. That's the reason why I'm not voting.
So 11. Okay. I've chaired terribly and we're running behind, so should we break now? I think we'll break now and reconvene at 1:20.